Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting to you from the coast of California. I'm joined today by my colleague, Mr. Jorge Facinetti. Welcome, Jorge. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you.
Jorge, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, today I thought we'd discuss the results of our recent acromegaly survey. About a week ago or so, we posted a five-minute survey on our Facebook page and a PWN website. I thought it was a very interesting idea to do this survey in that it would give us a sense of our community's experience with this really tough disease. I had a chance to look at some of the numbers and comments, and I was really delighted with some of the comments we got, which are definitely worth noting. What did you think?
I found the results of the survey to be rather interesting, so let's talk about some of those things, and we'll work through the different subsections of that survey.
Sounds great. Go ahead.
All right. 125 persons completed the survey, and of those, 86% were women. That, of course, is not typical of acromegaly, and it's equally distributed among the sexes. Most of those respondents were middle-aged. Of interest, 22% of patients received their care through private practice, 30% through university practice, about 24% through a pituitary center, and 13% co-managed with an expert at a center and a private practitioner.
Wow, that's quite a low percentage. Only 24% of the people that responded were treated at a pituitary center. Given what we know about the success rates of pituitary centers versus other non-specialized institutions, I would have expected a higher percentage here.
Now, in keeping with what we see in clinical practice, 75% of patients harbored macroadenomas, while 23% had microadenomas, and a couple of people had tumors that had not been identified, and one person had a neuroendocrine tumor. The treatments received by our respondents were typical of what we see in clinical practice. About 30% of patients had received surgery only, 38% surgery and medical therapy, a small proportion surgery and radiotherapy, whereas about 29% had received surgery, radiotherapy, and medical therapy. The vast majority of persons had only undergone one operation. In fact, that was 85%. 11% had two operations, and about four respondents had had three operations. Now, of those who had received radiotherapy, 40% received conventional radiotherapy, while 60% had undergone stereotactic radiosurgery. The vast majority of persons were treated with one course of radiotherapy, while a few had received two courses, and one had even reported receiving five courses of radiation.
So in the survey, we asked the status of the respondents' medical therapy for their acromegaly, whether they had ever used any medication, or they used medication in the past but not currently, or they were currently taking one or more drugs to treat their acromegaly. So let's talk a little bit about the therapy that people receive. Now, I learned mainly through you that these tumors often require multiple modalities of treatment, meaning that there is there's more than one thing that people can do. That is, there's maybe more than one tool in the toolbox, and you can use a combination of tools to manage a patient.
Well, Jorge, I also found the results of the survey in regards to medical therapy to be rather interesting. 24% of those who filled out the survey had no exposure to medical therapy whatsoever. 21% had previously been treated with drugs for their acromegaly, and 55% were currently on medical therapy.
Of those patients on medical therapy, about half were taking a somatostatin analog, with 60% of those being on sandostatin LAR, and about 40% taking somatuline depot. Only 12% of patients were taking pegvisomant, 20% were treated with cabergoline, and 8% with bromocriptine. Only a very small proportion of patients were treated with more than one drug.
Are you surprised at all about those findings?
Jorge, I'm not too surprised by the findings. Most of the early guidelines for the management of acromegaly focused on the use of somatostatin analogs as first-line medical therapy for patients with residual or recurrent acromegaly. So that's in keeping with what we see here. I found it of interest that a significant proportion of patients were treated with dopamine agonist drugs.
This might reflect practices in the UK and other countries and compared to those in the United States, but it also might reflect our patient population where most of those respondents were women. And in my own practice, I've found that women respond better to dopamine agonist drugs for acromegaly than do men.
I will say that the proportion of respondents taking pegvisomant or somavert was much smaller than I anticipated.
I noticed on the survey that for those patients currently taking somavert, 83% of patients were taking it daily, whereas a small proportion of people were taking it every other day, twice weekly, or once weekly. Tell us about that.
Interestingly, the pharmacokinetics and dynamics of this drug allow patients to take it at less than a daily interval. For those patients controlled with daily intervals, it might be worth trying to take it every other day or maybe twice weekly just to see if you can get control with fewer injections.
Well, I can honestly say I'm all for that. One of the questions we asked had to do with people currently taking somatostatin analogs and would be their interest in taking an oral form of octreotide preparation. It was really not surprising at all to see that fully 78% said they would be interested in an oral version of a somatostatin analog. As you know, the pharmaceutical company Chiasma has developed an octreotide capsule for the treatment of acromegaly. For our listeners, by the way, Chiasma is a late-stage biopharmaceutical company that focuses on developing and commercializing oral forms of therapies that are currently available only by injection, and they focus on rare orphan diseases. I did a bit of research on this, and it looks like they have successfully developed a technology that facilitates the gastrointestinal absorption of a drug into the bloodstream very safely. Last year, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, accepted the new drug application, and a decision on this is expected fairly soon. So it looks like it would be a welcome change for people currently using the injection. It's always great to see advances in drugs that make people's life a bit easier, no?
Yes, Jorge, this is something that will be interesting to see once this drug becomes available. It should be of interest to many patients, as most patients that I go through the different treatment options with ask me if there's an alternative to injections. Of course, I talk about dopamine agonist drugs, but this presents another option or, if you will, drug in our armamentarium to treat this disease process.
Well, yes, Dr. Blevins, as one who takes a daily injection, I can honestly tell you that it would be a welcome change, I think, for any patient. Although I have to tell you that I'm so used to the injections, it's almost like brushing your teeth. Now, I don't even really think about it. This is all really fantastic information. So what would you like to discuss next?
Next, I'd like to discuss the survey results that surprised me the most, namely those results that focus on disease control. First, of those patients who were not on medical therapy, only 44% described having a normal IGF-1, whereas 44% had elevated IGF-1s, indicating their disease was not controlled, and 11% of respondents did not know their IGF-1 level. Of those patients on medical therapy, 49% responded having a normal IGF-1, 37% stated their IGF-1 levels were not controlled, and 13% did not know their IGF-1 levels.
So 44% of our respondents who are not on medication report an abnormal IGF-1 level. These patients should be on medication, and they are not. Talk about an opportunity to increase awareness. No. What's most surprising is that these are people diagnosed with acromegaly. They should know that most therapies to control IGF-1 work quite well. This was also really surprising to me, like you just reported, for those who are taking medications for acromegaly, 13% did not know what their IGF-1 level was. That is really a big number. I just think it's so important to know what your IGF level is after each doctor visit for acromegaly.
I like to think that acromegaly used to be that difficult to treat, but it's not that difficult in this day and age with all of the different medical therapies that we have at our disposal.
In my opinion, it should be the rare patient or the exceptional patient that's not controlled, and most people should be able to have a normal IGF-1 as a consequence of a combination of surgery, additional surgery if required, radiotherapy, and medical therapy with any one of these drugs.
So I would encourage those of you who are not controlled to challenge your physicians to work better to get yourself under control or to seek consultation from an experienced clinician at a pituitary center of excellence so that you can find the best approach to the management of your acromegaly as an individual patient and get things under control so that you don't suffer from this horrible disease process.
Well, I think these findings support our argument for the need to inform and make people aware, and importantly, increase the reach of all of this information to people that are not getting it now. We know because we hear it all the time that there are loads of information out there, but much of it is just not getting to people. It really makes a strong case for efforts like Pituitary World News, whereby using creative approaches, we can get this information to people and make a real difference. So, Dr. Blevins, what else should we discuss?
Jorge, in the survey, you gave respondents an opportunity to comment, and we had a number of interesting comments that we've reviewed. And I wonder if you would sort of share with us an overview and collate some of those responses and bring to light some of those things that we have learned that we can share with our listeners so that they can benefit from the collective wisdom of the group of those who responded to the survey.
Yes, of course. We did add an area for comments, and as usual, many respondents shared very interesting experiences. As a patient myself with controlled acromegaly, I am always struck by how similar many of these experiences are. So about 28% of total respondents left comments. And one of the things that stood out for me was that quite a few people had relatives who they thought had acromegaly, but were never diagnosed. The genetics of pituitary disorders, specifically acromegaly, is coming up more and more with our community. So I should remind everyone, we are working on a series about heredity and genetics. So we will soon be asking everyone to send stories and experiences on this subject. It was good to see many people reporting on the successes of their treatments and hope to be, as one person put it, weaned off my shot. I thought that was a very funny comment. There were quite a few questions that we will try to answer individually, even though it is always optional. We like to ask for people to share their email addresses so we can connect with them directly. Many people reported on their success and or failures of one medication versus another and the struggle to find the one that worked. Interestingly, one person reported a diagnosis of extremely high levels of ghrelin along with significant weight gain after pituitary surgery and suggested creating and participating in a study to try to find answers to those issues. We have published a couple of articles on that, but to remind everybody, ghrelin is a hormone that increases appetite and plays a role in body weight. One respondent shared a diagnosis of acromegaly, but without any noticeable physical growth, reporting GH-producing pituitary tumor, causing over 20 years of headaches, but finding the right medication and becoming headache-free. It really is wonderful to hear all these stories and learn about the successes and the struggles of everyone in our community. So we encourage people to write to us and comment, and hopefully soon we'll be able to collate a lot of these comments into a a report or an article that we can share with everybody, because I do agree we learn a lot from everybody's comments and stories, and I thank you for that.
Jorge, thank you for taking the time to share those insightful responses with us, and also your perspective as a patient with the disease process as well. It's very useful to our listeners and also to the physicians out there who are having an opportunity to hear from their patients.
Well, like you, I think we are poised to make a real difference here. Put these disorders on the radar so both patient and doctors focus on the diagnosis, so people don't go such a long time without being properly diagnosed.
As usual, I've enjoyed the opportunity to have this dialogue with you, Jorge. Thank you so much for everything that you do for Pituitary World News on behalf of our listeners and followers. I would like to take the opportunity to thank those who participated in our survey and ask the listeners to look forward to future surveys and please contribute. We like to hear what you have to say. So have a good day, Jorge. And to those of you who are listening, whether it be daytime or nighttime, I wish you all the very best. Thank you.